you find out that you get more in touch with it, it touches you more, the more you're willing to face the direction of the steps in the program where it started. You know, the second step says, we'd like you to face the direction of where the help's coming from. We tend to rely on alcohol. I drank idolatrously. I'm an alcoholic. When I drink, I ask alcohol to take care of me the way only a higher power can take care of me. I ask it to do it for me. I don't ask it to make me happy. I ask it to take care of me during this hour while I'm high. And insofar as I have a belief in control, I ask my powers of manipulation to take care of me. My power to weasel and evoke sympathy and scare you and convince you and be quicker than, I rely on my powers of persuasion to change you enough so that you'll be good enough to me so that I can make it through the day. I'll rely on that. And the 12 steps say, we'd like you to rely on a power of love and wisdom that manifests itself when you work the steps and live in the fellowship. It isn't that you don't think anymore or persuade or do. You can try to persuade people, fine. Then turn over results, you know. But you don't count on getting the results. Whenever we are dealing with, whenever we're using idols, using money or alcohol or sex or persuasion, when we start counting on those things, relying on those things so that we can make it, we always have the results in mind. It's always result or keyed on results. I'm relying on this so that I get the result, so that I'll get high enough so that I'm immune from you getting me. I want the result, you know. And in this thing of faith, it says we'd like you to come forward and enter into this way of life where we start treasuring the kind of relationship we're given, a relationship that's based on mutual respect and honesty about what's wrong with us, and learning how to tell the truth, and rely on that way of life primarily, and then even give up the result. And then you'll get results that are a lot better ever by miles than when you wouldn't give up the result. And here, I wanted to make, I'm getting off, there's a point that's almost escaping me here, and that is, it's strange, but as we give ourselves in faith and say, okay, I'll buy into this, I'm going to sign this, I believe that a power greater than myself is restoring me to sanity. As we give ourselves over to a relationship to a higher power, to the universe, that's different than this working it out in private that we've been doing for so many years, it seems like you would give yourself away and somehow your own dignity as an independent person would suffer. And it's just the opposite. How that we do not turn ourselves into a Jim Jones kind of thing. We don't turn ourselves in and abdicate responsibility for our lives. Faith doesn't work that way. We are walking the path of faith, and what happens is it wakes us up more, and we become more alert to what in the heck's really going on around us. And we notice people easier. And we start getting a little better judgment about what it is we do that hurts and what it is we do that helps. And we actually become more independent and responsible. And it's up to us to make our decisions and what we do next. And it's a strange thing, isn't it? You'd think it'd be more responsible when you're just off by yourself alone and you're, by golly, I'm doing it, I'm taking care of myself. And what we're in is in a secret, weirdo relationship with a weirdo relationship with alcohol or pills, that I have this pact that I have to get enough for you to take care of me, and I have to be sure no one knows about this because it was harder to get the stuff when they know. And then my relationship with everyone else is really screwed up. And that relationship to a power greater than ourselves in the tradition of the 12 steps actually brings us out into the community and turns the lights on. And our relationships are much more simple and honest with everybody. And we have a chance to be responsible and independent and not abdicate. I can't explain that. I can kind of describe it a little bit. And as it happens to you, you kind of know. Now, kind of a theme here and the point of the second step, that as if you're rejoicing right now and kind of a fresh faith in your life and what I say, just kind of identify a little bit, you say, yeah, right on. Or if this is a real tough thing for you, you just, they bring up faith in God, it kind of grinds you a bit. And because you want, it's so bad. And yet it doesn't seem to be working. One point that I've been trying to make is that we don't figure out a faith. We let the experiences that some higher power gives us, draws us into as we begin recovery. We need to be taught by our own experiences. And if you identified with much of what I said at all about being drawn into the program and then being given some help that you weren't even interested in and not given the help you wanted, and another characteristic of God's help is that it always puts you in better shape to relate to other human beings. When you're helped by God, you're a better person to be around. You may not look any better. You may be much more aware of your own goofiness, but you're better to other people. You're better at it, of being, you're better at loving. You know? And usually when we're hurting real bad, we're not asking, higher power, please make me a little more kind and loving, so I can, that way, I'll probably, people don't pray that way when we're in the middle of our disease. Please make them nicer to me and get them off my back and let me not be so sick. So we have these, in other words, look to the experience. We have a wealth of spiritual awakening going on. Look to the, and when you listen to other people and their stories, listen especially for the way they've been touched in a new faith. Because if you listen hard for that, you will hear your own experience. We have things happen to us that we don't have words for. And the experience kind of sits there inchoate, you know, not understood and not described, and it kind of takes us identifying with other people for this to kind of come alive and start being more of, take up more room within us. My time has been up for a few minutes, so I stop. Let's turn this off.
This is the end of session 2, the start of session 3.
I invite everyone to mosey toward a seat and find your niche. Oh, the table's in here already. Drying off, yeah. We got to warm up with the announcements a little bit. Remind you that those who sign up, talk one-on-one, it's right over there at the chapel, and the door is at this end of the chapel, kind of in the back of nearest door you can find, the right. Part of the thing, it's after this session and we have our next sharing meeting that you have the longest break. It's you have several hours there. 2 hours? Well, 2.5. I want to encourage you to make the most of your alone time. Sometimes we have to plan a little bit and make a decision to see to it that we're alone for at least an hour so you can have that way of being for a while. And sometimes when I find myself in similar circumstances, I'll just kind of drift into one conversation after another and it's all over and I'm tired. So if you plan a little time to rest up, go to sleep or hide out, go for a walk, whatever you want to do, whatever seems good to you, you think ahead. The other thing is that I will... I plan to celebrate Mass in this room at 5:00. And we brought the table that will be the altar in to dry out. It's kind of waterlogged. and get a little cloth over it. And at Mass, it's an optional thing for a retreat. This is a, you know, an interdenominational, non-denominational retreat. And so, but the Mass is a Roman Catholic Christian thing. So if you want to attend, everyone's invited to attend that. They're warmly invited. If you're uncomfortable with the whole notion, then don't go to it. Be comfortable someplace. But just a couple of aspects of it. I just want to mention that it's going to be, it is important that we have a little kind of a sacred space for it. So if you're going to not be at it, I would ask you not to kind of hang around the other places, you know, where it would be harder to for noise and stuff like that. And some people ask about receiving Holy Communion, if that's appropriate, you know, for, well, in principle, everyone in the world is invited to receive communion, because it's only appropriate to say that the part of the meaning of receiving communion is that that's your faith, that you believe in Jesus Christ, and you, and that's a part of the expression of that faith is this, the sacrament of the Lord's Supper, Mass, and that, and it's a way of joining up. It's a sacrament of initiation. So if you're a visitor and you're kind of thinking, look this over, well, then it would not be appropriate to receive, because it's a sign you're joining up the community and you're part of that community. But you're very welcome to absolutely be here. You're welcome to receive communion. You're going to step forward and maybe, but if you're not ready to kind of be part of it today, then it would be later you do that. People asking about other religions, is that there's no official intercommunion between Christian religions yet. They haven't worked that out. If that's part of your faith, though, I'm very comfortable with people having an unofficial intercommunion, and welcome you to make up your mind, and welcome you to be here and prayerfully join in the spirit of the prayer and sharing. If I say any more, we'll get a major. You'll get a credit for theology. with that, I hope you're not. This isn't on the tape, is it? We're not taping yet, are we?
Yeah, I turned it off.
Let's pray the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. I'd like to share a bit about the notion of surrender. The third step, made a decision to turn our life and our will over to the care of God as we understand Him. This is the heart of the spiritual life and recovery. And it's and I always scratch around for a way to start out, because it's so interesting. There's so many angles on this thing. And what occurred to me today is it's a revolutionary step. Totally. And when I first hear surrender, believe me, I sure don't. When I first read the third step and gave it some thought, I sure didn't get it straight about what they meant. And I'm somebody with upper division credits. And surrender. I studied surrender professionally before I drank. There's a department of theology called ascetical theology, and it has to do with the principles of becoming a saint, principles of sanctity. And surrender and giving oneself over to higher power and living in that relationship totally in a receiving way. Anything you say, higher power, any suggestions? I'm ready for the will of God to be the main thing. That's the heart of it. And I just didn't get it. When I'd read the surrender step, it seemed to me that what they were doing was trying to make it palatable. The bad news, palatable. You know, trying to say, well, you must surrender. But what they meant was, the fun is over. That time to start getting serious and keeping all the resolutions you could never keep. Doing it right. Shape up. No more messing around. And yet we say surrender and make it sound like that was the impression I'd receive after my graduate course. Because I had my eye I was affected by fear in a way I did not understand, and I had my eye on results. Results, results, results. And this surrender that we're invited, what our higher power does here is invites us into taking the third step and says, in effect, if I might paraphrase what I think my higher power is saying to me, he's saying, I got good news for you. I'm going to let you off the hook. You've been torturing yourself. You got yourself in a double bind, a no-win proposition, day in and day out. You've assigned yourself the task of becoming happy and fulfilled by getting your own way a lot. And you can't get your own way enough to be happy and fulfilled if that's the standard of happiness and fulfillment, is getting your own way a lot. You just get frustrated too much. You can't get them to cooperate. You can't get your own insides to cooperate enough. You got enough hang-ups and defects of character, and they're not too anxious to get into your program and to cooperate with you. And so you've got yourself a possible assignment. Learn how to drink right. Learn how to drink with... And I'm going to let you off the hook and show you a way to live with some inner peace and harmony, with maximum harmony with your fellows, your brothers and sisters, where you don't have to condemn yourself to this kind of frustration. Isn't that good news? Yeah. That's what I consider surrender to be. We're invited into this. He says, come forward, and you say, turn your life and your will over to the care of God. And that sounds so religious, so spiritual. If you do that, you're pretty sure it'll jeopardize your financial and sex life a lot. From what you know of God, He has not been interested in seeing you get more money or sex, and that probably won't be part of the program. Again, the results thing. But we still are drawn forward because that's the logical place to be. We hit bottom and realize that we are being helped out. Realize we're being helped enough to start having a faith and a power greater than ourselves. And this surrender, and again, back to the... We look at everything and out of the window that we're accustomed to looking out of. The window I've done most of my looking from is the window of fear. The window where I'm threatened, I'm just pretty anxious that people think well of me to reassure me I'm all right, and I'm anxious that that I get a good rating so that at least I'm above average in most respects. I'm anxious that I not be bereft and left alone, and I get my turn, and I have a little fun, and of course be spiritual, and generous and rich. Pretty important to have these things, and have a relationship that fulfills me. Relationships, and our higher power is saying, "Look, I have to ask you to simply realize that as you look out of that window, you will remain frustrated forever. Why don't you look out of a different window? Look out of the window where you're invited not to be the center of the universe, embattled, worried about critics and those against you, those frustrating you, but to look out of the window where you are one of God's children. You are loved by your higher power, and you're one of God's children, and you're not the center of the universe. And that's going to let you off the hook. See, while I'm the center of the universe, everybody's my adversary, because you're the only way you can be good unto me is by cooperating with my version of being the center. And when I'm not the center, but when I'm kind of holding hands, this is the way I do after a meeting, and forming a circle around a higher power, and I'm one of the folks, I realize that I don't have to have things, quote, turn out all the time. And that's the breaking in of this new thing. I can't emphasize too much that it's always transformation. It's it's doing it in a radically different way. That's what surrender invites us to do. Now, the minute we get into a bit of surrender, let me describe surrender on the three levels first. Surrender is affirming our relationship to a higher power, saying, God, you're God, and I'm not. I'm one of the folks. And I want to learn to live in, you know, what do you do to live? See, that's the surrender question. The non-surrender question is, how do I get it? How do I get the result I know I got to have? How do I lose weight, stop drinking, get more money, have a better relationship, and get it all nailed down? How do I get that? And it is, we'll just have to ask you to stop asking that. We'll have to ask you to stop and ask a different. We'd like you to ask, what do I do next to live in harmony as a child of God? What do I do to make it around here? Aha! Now there's something possible, see? Because we can't achieve the results. And we say, well, one of the things you do is show up at meetings and be open for identification. And when you find yourself identifying with somebody, we'd like you to know that that doesn't threaten your life and that's all right. When you identify with other alcoholics and say, oh my God, I'm more of an alcoholic than I thought. Don't worry about that. That's good. You identify more. And let's say you find yourself not worried about results, but you're, again, we get free demonstrations. Our higher power kind of draws us into surrender on many levels, and then he asks us to affirm, to sign our name to it later. I found that my basic surrender, I stumbled into. I think maybe most people do, but I stumbled into the beginning of real surrender. I'd been hospitalized 5 times in an aversion treatment hospital, once in a psychiatric division of a major hospital, and then shipped to New Jersey. They weren't waiting with bated breath in Los Angeles to see how I'd do. After multiple hospitalizations, they're not waiting anymore to find out. We're written off, kind of, which is healthy in a way. Written off in that sense of ever turning out the way I wanted to turn out. Fine. Okay, I'm back in New Jersey. And the deal was, you had to go to 4 meetings a week and they wouldn't feed you. Okay, go. It's okay, I'll do that. More. And as I went to meetings and began to be drawn into the fellowship, into the program, I was doing stuff that has to do with surrender. Now, I didn't even know. Somehow our higher power takes away from us the burden of clutching onto results the way we have been accustomed to, you know? We were trying to drink right and get away with it for years. And then we finally just, we stopped clutching it because we're just tired of it. I'm clutching, I want to make this marriage work. I want to make these kids behave. And if I just do this and that, and finally you just, the results, we don't clutch the results because it's so evident that we're not going to get the result. That we just kind of... Okay, that combined with simply taking a hand. Remember, the surrender thing is obsession with results transformed into an agreement to live with a relationship where we do footwork. I do footwork instead of obsessed with results. And so another way of imaging the image is that I'm in the center of the universe working out by myself the best I can to be, and then so much pain and frustration that I get demoralized and stop doing it. And then someone reaches out a hand. The program reaches out a hand and says, will you take my hand? I'd like you to walk this way and wake up. You say, well, I'm not so sure what is this anyway you're going to do? Will you take my hand? Come with me a few steps. You just got to take a chance for a few steps. If I wait until you understand this, we are going to wait forever. In fact, there's no way to understand it without being a good sport and trying it out a little bit. Well, since there's absolutely nothing else going on in my life, and there's nothing else holds any promise, whatever, we kind of take the hand and walk along with it. So I'm walking along holding somebody's hand instead of working things out in private. This is a revolution. This is a totally different approach to life, walking along holding a hand. And as I'm doing that, I'm being drawn into some mutuality, into a mutual sharing of stuff on a level, on a deep enough level, where it's shocking. People are saying these awful things about themselves. It's very embarrassing. They say this stuff out in public. And then we're asked to agree to be a part of the group, and we find we are anyway, whether we agree or not. We find ourselves beginning to live like an alcoholic, live like an Al-Anon, live according to the truth of our guts, of our insides. And it's like a fiat accompli. It's done. We're into it. And that's what I found. I was going to meetings every single day, twice on Saturday. And I was hanging out with alcoholics, and I was feeling this deep thing. Of course I'm alcoholic. And I felt peaceful about being alcoholic. And so I was in a relationship, a new kind of relationship with a higher power, and started to surrender, agree, to simply live as a child of God and do this footwork. Now, as I was kind of tricked into doing it, just because I just said to it, I said, okay, I can't think of anything else right now. And as it began to take a little bit, and I began to surrender, there's a remarkable thing about surrender. On the one hand, it seems very unnatural to do it. And on the other hand, the minute we do it, it seems very natural. It seems, well, of course I'm alcoholic. I mean, any dummy can see that. And we got relaxed with it. Of course, sharing on a level of emotional honesty, where you listen to other people take their turn and I take my turn, of course that's a humane, human, sensible sort of a way to live this. I'm a human being. I'm a social animal. I need to have other people share their guts so I can identify and get reaffirmation that I'm, of course, once you're doing it, it's your, why, of course, it's natural as can be. Any of us want to do that when we're drinking? Go to a meeting and wait 50 minutes for your turn? I mean, that's just absurd. That's why when a person is under the influence, they don't do well in the whole meeting, you know. But there's levels of surrender. I want to distinguish three levels. The full surrender, all out, the nausea level, and the not yet ready level. And the full level is full of paradox, because the minute I fully surrender and just let go, and I find myself not fighting anything, half because I lost the energy to fight, and the other half is I begin to identify with people who are not fighting, and they gave me permission. You're not being unpatriotic when you don't fight yourself. And so the combination of the two things, I actually relax for a few minutes. And I relax and I'm in harmony and I'm not fighting who I am and what I am. And I find out, oh, this is nice. Surrender, once we're doing it, is invisible. Once we're doing it, you don't feel especially religious or spiritual. You just feel sane. You just feel like you've stopped doing some real dumb things. You just feel like you're not giving yourself an arbitrary, stupid, bad time. Full surrender is the simplest kind of respect for reality, the way it is. It's agreeing to live in the world as it is. Of course, if you don't agree to live in the world as it is, the world stays exactly the same anyway. And the only difference is that I have a tightened gut, and I'm in conflict and turmoil. And when I agree to live in the world as it is, anything else other than that seems so stupid that I wonder why I ever did it. You take the issue of surrendering in a relationship. It doesn't mean letting the other person use you as a doormat. It means being willing to let that other person be who and what they are fully, unconditionally without any reservations. You give them permission to be the big jerk they are. Or you give them permission to be the beautiful person they are. And it's the same thing. You know, if you can't see they're a beautiful person, then you can't surrender. If you know they're a jerk who's a beautiful person, you have a chance. You can just give them permission. They have all the hang-ups and all the... Give them permission to be somebody who can't listen, to be somebody who can't catch on to the easiest thing in the world. Once we've done that, we notice at least two things. And we can't do that by ourselves, only with God's help. Only in the program, surrounded by a cloud of witnesses, surrounded by a lot of support, can we let another person truly be. And as soon as you let another person be, even if it's for like 10 minutes, there's two things. One is, you will, the goodness and beauty God put in that person becomes available to you. They're cute. There's a certain the beauty and the interest they have is now available because we're not fighting them. And the other is that they don't get on your nerves the same way at all. They just don't drive you nuts. Instead of being a jerk who drives you nuts, they become a character. Yeah. Now it just about kills you to do this, of course, and we only do it with God's help. But the minute we do it, it's like the air here today, the sunshine and clear air blowing by. You say, well, what else would I do? Like not let them be who they are? When you're letting somebody be who they are, it's so manifestly obvious that that's the only sane thing to do that it's impossible to imagine not doing it. Until we have some pressure that makes us take it back 5 minutes later. We release somebody, it seems like if we do that, they'll go right down the tubes without our support of holding them in place. They'll just fall apart if I'm not insisting they don't. And of course, surrendering somebody improves them a lot. They have this big overhaul right before your eyes. Now, when we're surrendering, the deep surrender we experience not as a great feat that we deserve some applause for or credit for. We experience deep surrender for what it really is, a blessing from God. Simple sanity. Nothing more than simple sanity. It's just what anybody would do if they couldn't keep any secrets and all the lights were on. All the emotional, mental lights, you know, all the things. Now, the nausea level. The nausea level is that level of surrender where you're talking to your sponsor and you're explaining a few reasons why you're miserable and because of the person you're living with who's is so unreasonable and hostile and full of deceit. And your sponsor says, well, you know, you didn't just find this out. And you've been living there a long time. You think your own attitude may have some play here. That you're kind of sitting there hanging on. You've decided that they don't have any more excuse for certain behavior because they should know enough by now. And you're hanging on to this thing saying, they should change, they should change, and they won't, and it's just outrageous, and it's unjust. And I refuse to be relaxed or happy until they change. You think that maybe your own insistence that they be different might be the biggest single factor in your anguish right now. That somebody who is sick and who is kind of not too loving, they're difficult to be around. But when we add our own lack of surrender in our own funny ways, it just redoubles and triples and quadruples the anguish that results in being around a person like that. And your sponsor suggests that maybe when you let that person go entirely, that it won't make life just perfect, but it will take away probably 3/4 of all the anguish you have. And if you begin to believe just a little bit of that, you get sick to your stomach immediately. There's a nausea, you know. This thing of... that somehow the little flashes of fear come in that it's like your fault and they're going to make fun of you. And then you're going to have to let something be. And you're afraid if you let those muscles relax that you just might disappear or fall apart or you won't know who you are. It makes you sick to your stomach, sick of fear and self-loathing and embarrassment. And you could have done this years ago. You can just do this by yourself. You don't need the other person's cooperation. You've been waiting for them to do something for years. And now you're finding out that you can do something without waiting for them. That's the key deal, you know. It is so embarrassing that you're sick to your stomach. And then as soon as you make the move and start letting go, the nausea passes. We even feel disloyal at that point. Especially with kids. If you surrender your children, well, you just feel like you're an irresponsible parent if you don't insist that they turn out right. And of course, when we retire from being God, don't play God, and let God be God in ourselves, you know, your obligation is to, if you do have children, is to be a mother and not God. As we begin to make the move, the nausea does begin to pass. We start getting over it, and then when we're in the surrender, again, it's like clear air. And it's as if, well, of course I do this. Why would I do anything different? Once we're in surrender, it just seems impossible not to do it. Then there's a not ready yet level. And that has to do with those issues in our life where we're bedeviled still by some behavior or some feelings that we have conflict about them. They bother us. We can't decide whether it's so bad or wrong, but it bothers us. Anybody have any obsessive habits that, you know, anyone have a problem with procrastination? Now, this kind of goes, I touched on this last night with the thing of, you know, accepting ourselves as procrastinators, you know, who would do one thing in front of us. Adulterers, commit adultery or don't commit adultery today and give thanks if you don't have to be in anguish. But let's say procrastination. Procrastination is deferring things. I think the root of it is fear, sort of a perfectionism. That I don't want to do it until I'm pretty sure I'll do it well enough not to be humiliated and made fun of. And while I'm considering how to do it right, four more things come in to do. And which now makes me have five things to do. It's much more difficult to do five things than one and to do it well enough for my own standards. And so this is a bigger problem, so I must contemplate more deeply how to do five. And there are... by the time I start making the first move, there are nine more things. And then mail came, and I'm in despair. We want to get over this, you know. And so you've got to struggle around with it and pray and turn it over and so forth. And still, there's a certain pattern in your life of procrastination and the kind of anguish and pressure that goes along with that. And so you've worked surrender. You said the surrender prayer, you've done this and that, and you're still... opening your mail by opening this. Well, I'm going to have to do something about that. Now, what's the next thing? Advertisement. Well, I know I probably don't want it, but I wonder. So I read a little bit about it. And I might want this later. I don't know. And then there's a little bill here. Well, I'll have to pay it today. So you've opened up all the mail and haven't made one decision. Anyway, I don't want to go on too long, but the point is, how does surrender come in this thing? If you're in the middle of something, an obsessive compulsive habit of eating chocolate at night or having multiple affairs or not making decisions when you open up the mail, and it sort of bugs you. You know, it's on your mind a lot about the mess in your desk or your kitchen. So does surrender have anything? Now, you might think, well, yeah, it says, so turn it over to God and do your footwork and get it done and you'll be all right. Right? What about when you turn it over to God and you keep behaving the same way? And then you say, well, that's just, I don't know, this doesn't work with surrender. I'll just put this over in another compartment and go on. And we've tried to surrender it, and we've got it in the surrender prayer, and we've done some things like that. And it still hasn't changed very much. Then there's some resistance and holding on to something that's down deep enough below the surface, but we don't have access to it. So the surrender question is, are you willing to be a person with an obsessive compulsive habit that you don't have access to the roots of, you don't understand? Are you willing to be that? Are you willing to get up today and live your life with a willingness to be enlightened, but knowing you're not enlightened yet, and you're hanging on to some old ideas and fear in regard to this thing? Are you willing to show up and know that you're not making much progress on this, but you're willing to be it? You're willing to be a person with a sex problem, with a fear problem, with a money problem, with a stealing from the store problem. You're willing to be that. You can't fake it. You've got to be really willing to have a problem you can't solve in your terms right away. But you're willing to keep on the table and not make a complete secret of, tell somebody about, and to be willing to do some footwork and willing to have the footwork not pay off in the terms you'd like it to pay off, which is, make it go away. Or, make the guilt go away so I can enjoy myself more. Or something. You know, to get the tension down so I feel better. Results. And the surrender says, no, you don't get to pick your results. We want you to show up before your higher power with your real life as it is, turn yourself in, and be willing to do footwork and trust God to show His love and care for you while you are unfinished. While you are voluntarily or involuntarily hanging on to some thing where you don't even understand yourself. That's the not ready yet surrender. And you say, well, Father, are you just kind of making an elaborate rationalization so we can keep, so you can keep doing or we can keep doing whatever the hell you want to do? I hope not. No. I think we can misuse anything, you know. But I know myself and I've talked to many, many, many people. And I see people, you know, kicking themselves around and, you know, kind of endorsing surrender, but just figuring, well, it doesn't work for me and I can't do that. And I see a lack of a willingness to live in the presence of God with an unsolved problem. And to work our surrender means to be willing to live with an unsolved problem, you know, and not insist we get it all together in 2 minutes, or in 2 years, or in 10 years, and to keep showing up at the place where it works, you know, to be willing to like anyway. Back to that notion of results, I find that I have to. Think about this in an explicit way to work any kind of surrender in my life all the time. This is something that, you know, we say a surrender prayer, and I like to end the session with a surrender prayer, or the transition to a meeting. But that surrender prayer gets us to have surrender as our life policy. But the fifth, so it's real. You say the surrender prayer and mean it with God's help. It changes the way you live and the way you are. But it doesn't get our whole selves into surrender every minute. It's obvious because we have a lot of conflict still. That's our life policy. So it bothers us more when we don't surrender, after we surrender, than it did before we surrendered, because we didn't know what surrender was. But every time we do anything, all the way from saying, good morning, that's doing something, up till starting a law course, starting a new career, up to starting a new relationship. Every time we embark on the simplest little thing or the most demanding long-term thing, we have a result in mind, and it's not bad to have a result in mind. It's absolutely inevitable to have a result in mind, because we wouldn't get geared up to do anything unless we had a result in mind. And it's fine. It's just that as we stay, every time we start anything and there's a result in mind, as we do it, we have the habit of saying, higher power, you know what I want. I know what I want. I'd like this to work. Thy will be done, and I'm willing for it not to. To give the result away, if we think of it that explicitly. And if we sometimes we can get into a habit of doing it rather easily, and that just brings all kinds of peace, all kinds of maturity into our life. But we still have the result. We hope it works, and we'll shift a little bit and hope it comes close, you know. And if it doesn't, then we reorganize and do something different and do it over again. Take it to be very simple. Like, as soon as we turn over that result, then we're, you know, we have some security and we don't go crazy. We're not vulnerable to other people's behavior. So much. If I say good morning, I have a result in mind. I'd like you to look back at me and say good morning back. Now, if I surrender the result and I'm fundamentally willing for you not to say good morning back, it'll still kind of hurt my feelings if you don't. But it'll hurt my feelings. But if I've surrendered, after my feelings are hurt, my reaction to it will be, I wonder what's wrong with her. She must be kind of distracted or out of it today to not notice. I'll say a prayer for her. If I've not surrendered, I'll say, you're not going to catch me saying good morning to you. You know, you took something away from me. I gave, you didn't. You know, I'll have hostility and I'll be upset. It's all a matter of that totally different approaches. You know, as we start out in a relationship, if we want this relationship to work, it's fine. That's human. Everybody wants a relationship to work and be nice and turn out. If we insist that it turns out, it's like walking up to somebody and putting your hand on their elbow and squeezing and saying, honey, it's up to you now to make me happy. And I'm not letting go until you do. Or if we are willing, if we grant the other person total freedom and so forth, it kills you too, you know, because we want it to work so much. But we are willing, God, please let me have the willingness to let this person do whatever they're going to do and be whoever they want to be and let them go. And then, hello. A little conversation. And then we can, we're much better met. We don't scare people nearly as much when we've surrendered them. The same way you notice yourself, when you meet somebody who has not assigned you the role of making them happy, you can breathe easy. And as soon as you detect any assignment, then it's up to you now to make him happy. It's hard going, and you're not living in the world of surrender. So it's just a blessing. We often think of surrender in terms of doing something that's difficult, and that's a big deal. And boy, oh, I'm going to surrender and turn it over and give it away and let God's way be first and mine second. And like, we're really giving up a lot, you know? We're giving up grief and insanity and a grinding gut. It's really heroic, isn't it? But so often, it's impossible to do by ourselves. I think one of the aspects of surrender that I find, you know, very, maybe the worst, hardest myself, and I think it's very much human nature, is to agree to have all of your hang-ups and not push them. Let your fears and your phobias and your hang-ups and everything be just as they are. And ask God to help you do the next thing that's sensible for a person in your shape. And trust God to love you and she'll care for you while you're in the shape you're in. That to me is the most difficult thing in the world. There's a feeling that first I got to get over this and that, and then I'll be positioned well for moving ahead. But I'm not positioned well. Wait a minute, God. Wait a minute. I'm going to take this. My sponsor said that the unforgivable sin is to avoid God until you're in good enough shape to fool him. To somehow just not bring it up to God until you're in better shape. You know? And a lot of times, you know, with the awareness, the ACA thing, you know, we become aware of how we get our reaction to a sick family has resulted in our being wired in a way, you know, kind of the readiness to do real stupid things, to kind of get very attracted to sick people, to go into deep feelings of anxiety and guilt when other people are having problems. You know, take emotional responsibility for other people's problems. And Lila, and we think, I got to get over that. And surrender says, let's walk along the path of healing in the program. Let's be willing to have your history and your wiring and the way you are, and trust God as you do the steps to take care of you with your wiring. It's not tragic. You're going to do all right. You don't have to wait until you're over something before you're allowed to breathe and live. You do footwork, but we do it in a calm spirit. We do it in a step-by-step way. I'm a little late, but you were a little late too. So let's pray the surrender prayer together now. And then I'd like you to be patient. Wait a minute. Let's and count off again, okay? And we'll do this. What do we do first? Let's pray the prayer first, and then be good sports and stay where you can be counted for about 1 minute. Now let's get myself. Some of you know this by heart, some of you don't. If you don't know it by heart, just say amen at the end. God, I offer myself to Thee to build with me and to do with me as Thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do Thy will. Take away my difficulties, so that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of Thy power, Thy love, and Thy way of life. May I do Thy will always.
Amen.
Okay.
This is the end of session 3, the start of session 4.
There's a 6-word, 3-sentence summary of the program that you're all familiar with, I'm sure. Trust God, clean house, help others. And the middle part of that, clean house, is what I'd like to reflect on here. The middle steps of the program, taking inventory, sharing the inventory, the humility steps of 6 and 7, where we agree to let God work on us, and then beg Him to, and the amend steps. These steps are kind of under the heading cleaning house, telling the truth. And I use the word clean house, the phrase, because it gives me the creeps so much. I just hear clean house, and there's a chill up my spine, and oh God, clean house. Gotta confess and get my sins straight. And you know what that means. Once you confess them, there's got to be a firm purpose of amendment. This is Catholic language. And that means you can't do them again. And there's two results of not being able to do your sins again. One is that you really will not do them again and never have any fun for the rest of your life. Or you will do them again and feel like a failure and guilty and so forth. So it's, if you're reflecting on this whole issue in a spirit of fear, it's very discouraging. And of course, I've been talking about transformation. Transformation of attitude, transformation of spirit, transformation of the way we live, that it isn't a matter of finally getting enough strength to do what we always needed and had to be done. It's a matter of being led by our higher power to do it in another way. And I think this issue of telling the truth is right at the most stark instance of something changing in the middle. You know, the very nature of it changes as we come towards the program. You know, the fourth step comes after the first three. And the without the first three steps, it really would be stupid to take an inventory. Because all we would do is take it in our old attitude. We just write out a bunch of things we feel guilty about and feel bad, feel worse. An inventory is only safe and only makes sense when we've taken the first three steps or in the middle of them, you know, when we're drawn into them and have that spirit. And think of it this way. We're transformed from fear to faith. We're not transformed from being fearful people into being people full of faith with no fear anymore. A basic principle is that we never get over anything. We never get rid of anything entirely. Well, you can say you get rid of drinking entirely if you stay sober a day at a time. But we don't get rid of alcoholism at all. We don't get rid of our being fearful in many ways. What we do is add the program. We add the experience of being accepted with respect and love, and we add this faith thing. And as we add that, we get to live more and more in the spirit of faith while our fears are around. The more faith we have, the more program we have, the more the fears get scrunched up to the side and don't have much of an effect. They'll rush right back to center stage the minute they have room to move in. But there they are. Now, the experience we have, and I think all of us share this right here. You know, we lived a life where you lied. I lied a lot. I lied in a very systematic, never let up way when I drank. I didn't think of myself as lying very much. I thought I was a pretty good guy. I didn't even think I was lying unless I told a big fat lie. You know, the big fat one where you just lie. You know, tell them something different. But if it's anything short of that, I didn't count it as, you know, it's like exercising your right to privacy kind of thing. But to give some notion of how consistent my lying was, I kind of did a little role-playing in my imagination of what it would have been like had I ever told the truth while drinking. Now, I never did, but if I ever had told the truth while I was drinking, it would have gone something like this. I would have gone over, let's say you invited me over to the house for Saturday night social get-together, and I knew you well enough to know there'd be booze there. And if I was assured there'd be booze there and I didn't have a better offer, I'd say, sure, I'll be over. And if I were going to tell the truth, which I never did, I would have arrived at your house, knocked on the door, you'd answer the door, and I'd say, hi, thanks for asking me over. I'd like to lay my cards on the table and get a few things straight before we start out this evening. I'm here to drink. I'd like a double scotch right now. Before we go on anymore with any talk. Now. Okay. So I get my drink and say, look, you were nice enough to ask me over. I'm going to be a good sport. You got games to play? I'll play the games. Other people coming over? I'll mix it up. Usually this kind of an evening, I get a little bit gassed, but I do all right generally. However, it's only fair to warn you, sometimes I go crazy. I might throw up on the rug, get in a fight, try to seduce somebody. But that's the chance you take when you ask me over. You didn't tell the truth either, did you? See, when I'm living as an drinking alcoholic, or with the whole attitude, the whole fear way of life, it is to my interest that you not know a lot about what I'm up to and what I feel and what's going on, because it interferes with the whole project if you know too much, if you know hardly anything. I never tell. And that's a way of life. And the whole people-pleasing thing, the whole screening off that I try to control your reactions by just feeding you the stuff I want you to hear. They're just so deadening, you know. Just boring. Dullsville. life when we just tell each other the good stuff. You know, what we're waiting for is the real good stuff. You know, with some honesty about what's happening. So we come, and we're accustomed to this. You know, we lived for years with this practice thing of hiding our weaknesses, hiding what could be embarrassing, hiding anything that could be used by the enemy to make it harder to get a drink or make it harder or find us being despised. That fear. We come, fast forward into crashing and burning and the frustration of being a co in a family with just being obsessed with trying to help out and trying to change things. And if this is severe for someone who is in the family disease, who's not drinking, because almost all of the energy in trying to change the behavior of somebody else, when the focus is on changing behavior, good tactics always dictate that you parcel out the information very judiciously. You don't let them know certain things, you let them know other things. It's always manipulative when we have our focus on the behavior change, and you never let them know what you're really up to. It's always some kind of a little angle. And it gets them mad all the time. And there's reactive stuff. And so we come to the program with years of habit of this. And as you come in the program, come in a meeting, you hear people actually volunteering things that put them at a disadvantage in New York, where you usually live, you know. I remember going to my 12-step house in New Jersey, and there was a skinny priest named Father Mike, Mad Mike, we called him. And we just been to a meeting. I'd been to about one or two meetings. And he said, "Boy, do I have a resentment against that secretary of the Wednesday night Morris Plains meeting? I can't stand him. But, well, I'll turn him over and say a prayer." I had never heard an adult talk like that in my life. I had never heard a grown-up person acknowledge that they did something wrong and say they were going to try to correct it with God's help. I heard confessions, but I never heard anybody just say it in conversation. Priest or non-priest or man or woman. It was shocked. And then, of course, the reaction to him was, "Oh, yeah, Mike, he's a tough guy to get along with her." There was acceptance. And then you hear more and more of this stuff. And so all the rules are changed. See, it's turned upside down from having to hide stuff so that we won't be rejected and criticized and given a bad time and make it harder to get a drink. We get into this thing where the weight of our own secrets and the heaviness of all of this isolation and we're just not connecting, you know? We're not identifying enough to have any solace given to our hearts, and we're alone, and there's no real comfort because we don't get comfort by somebody saying, "Oh, poor thing. Poor baby." It doesn't give comfort. What gives comfort is someone else to tell you what they've done. And then when you say how you feel and what you've done, they'll say, "Yeah, I know what you mean." That you get comfort then. And so we start getting this thing where we say what's in our heart, and instead of anybody using that to their advantage, they receive it matter-of-factly, and we identify. And when that happens, that's a transformation right there, you know, on the spot. But then when it happens, there's further transformation. There's a transformation down deeper that because we identify and connect up with somebody and we don't feel alone anymore, well, then we don't feel so bad. And we know this is part of being a human being. And maybe we don't get over what we've just discussed and don't solve the problem on the spot. I know in my own background, I would hesitate to say things because I thought once I said it, I had to have a way to solve it completely. And I'd be skeptical about being able to solve it. Never have another drink again. Never have a dirty thought again. Never have the failure of courage and of perfectionism and of just being a procrastinator and avoidance person, that I don't want to talk about that stuff because I don't think I have it together enough to be better. I always wanted to work it out before saying something. You know? And we don't get to work. We work it out by saying something. And we say it, and almost always, as we share what we have to share, there's a funny kind of transformation. Before, we're obsessed with results. We're obsessed with observable change, where we're more efficient or more courageous or got it together, more charming, pretty or something. And instead of the observable results being different, it's just a greater solidarity with other people that just gives a solace to the heart. And we don't even change sometimes. We don't change the way we thought we'd change. You know, we kind of keep some hang up. You confess your hang up. You have a fear. You can't stand to go to the podium. You finally say, oh, I'll do anything. I won't go to that meeting because they have a podium. And I won't do this because I might have to stand up and say something. You say, I got it off my chest. I was honest. You still feel that way. But you may be able to do it and be nervous and be afraid of it and find out you lived. And then never... I have a little sister who's sober longer than I am in the fellowship. And she'll be 20 years sober next July. My little sister. She's afraid of the podium. She, with her brother being this maniac talker, she told a short version of her story the first time, a 9-minute version when she took her 6th birthday cake. And she's honest about that thing, but she's got this thing still kind of inhibition. So that, the way it goes. And they, just to sketch out this picture of the transformation still. Underline, it's not just a matter of confessing, but finally telling them. It's sharing in the atmosphere of our fellowship and program. That's what's healing. They say, well, that'd be, yeah, it's nice. Confession's good for the soul, and, you know, be honest. That's kind of nice. Well, it's not just kind of nice. It's life-saving. You see, when we're living in our disease, we're in pain. And we're in pain. There's two levels of pain, two that I distinguish. The deep level and the surface level. On the surface level, it's not trivial pain. Serious stuff on the surface. Broken bones, divorces, public humiliation, death of loved ones, fatal diseases, on and on. That, you say, you call it the surface? Yeah, it's pain that you know where it's coming from, and it's awful. But there it is. Then there's pain that's kind of dull and deep. And I call that the oceanic ache. That's the pain that goes along with this illness. It's a pain that's caused by the inability to be honest. The inability to be honest in an atmosphere of acceptance and trust. The inability to speak our heart so that we can be healed, so that we can be comforted. And every human being has a deep need to say what's inside and have someone else hear it and look back at us. We need to have that done. We yearn to have that done. If we don't get to do that, we are in isolation. We're in anguish. Because there's no connection and there's no felt understanding and love. We cannot believe we're loved if the one who supposedly loves us doesn't know our story. They just love an image, you know. They wouldn't love me if they knew. You know, no way. That's by the way the core belief of the addict. Read about the sexual compulsive behavior in Out of the Shadows, a book by Patrick Carnes. And he talks about the core beliefs of an addict. That the inside, and it works for, yeah, they're pretty loud outside too. The core beliefs, he said there's four core beliefs and only one of the beliefs has to do with a particular addiction. The first is, basically, I'm no good. Second, if they knew the truth, they'd reject me. They'd never accept me. Third, if I have to wait around for them to help me fulfill my needs, I'd wait forever. I got to take care of things myself. Fourth, control is my most important need. Sex is my most important need. Being sexually attractive as the co is my most important need. A drink is my most important need. A pill is. That will take care, that will give solace. We need solace. We need love. We need to be connected as children of God with one another. We just yearn for that. I gotta have it. And when it's blocked off, we're at an ache. I call the oceanic ache, just that dull pain. And that's the kind of pain that puts us in jeopardy of drinking again, of acting again. With that pain, you add one of those surface pains of the death of a spouse, a real setback, you lose your job. And if it's combined with the oceanic ache, we're gone. Go do something. Do something crazy. And when we get in the program, that oceanic ache begins to drain away. We still have all the troubles of life. But it begins to drain away so that once we're really working our surrender and self-acceptance and a faith leads us to start telling the truth in this kind of way that the middle steps lead us to do, and that ache begins to drain away, then all of those surface pains in life change the way they affect us. And we've experienced this already. If somebody dies and you have the oceanic ache, you have a drink because, God, you know, they died. Once we're in the program and that drains away, if somebody dies you love, I've got enough grief and trouble without drinking besides. It sharpens the motivation to be sober and increases our gratitude. And on down the line, lose your job? Well, I lost my job. I don't have much money. Insecure, I'm sure not going to drink besides that and make it worse, you know. So everything is turned, you see. Once that, our heart has the solace it needs, you know. And it's working the middle steps that does that. Working the middle steps that connects us up with God and other human beings so that we have this flow. The flow of recognition, love, understanding, acceptance. And once that's flowing and going on, we become very tough. You know, we're fragile in our own way. But once that's going on, nobody can take it away from you. Nobody can get you drunk, and nobody can get you to panic and live in control again. They just can't. Because the more pressure brought to bear, once the program's in place, the more motivation to work the program. It just locks in. So we begin to do this stuff, you know. It occurred to me the other day, I love paradoxes, you probably are noticing. Someone was extolling honesty, you know. I think I might have mentioned this at the opening night here. But when we actually practice honesty, it's not a smooth deal, you know. We still have our fear affecting us. And we're not so sure about this. And there's a certain amount, there's a certain despair and sense of failure, even a sense of death. In being honest. Because as we get honest, the old self dies. The old image bites the dust. You can't keep up the old front when you're talking against the old front. You know, oh my gosh. But it makes us feel disoriented, you know. What'll I do with get the new image, you know. And as we try it out and tell the truth, of course the instant the connection's made, then the anguish is over about losing our image and that kind of thing. The other thing about the way the fourth and fifth step is constructed, it'll sound, when we still have some fear affecting the way we read and understand, and we read that, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves, admitted to God, ourselves, and another human being the exact nature of our wrongs, If you hear it in that tone of voice, it seems like this is going to be kind of a guilty kind of trip here. And it there's a kind of the vibrations of blame going on there. We're going to have to write down everything that's our fault. What's your fault? What do you deserve blame for? And if you start doing an inventory with the attitude that I've got to write down the things I deserve blame for, and sometimes it'll stop you in your tracks. It's very depressing to write down things you deserve blame for. And then you could, because when we're in fear, that's a fear word, blame. And when we're in fear, we do one of two things with stuff that could be in our inventory. We either justify ourselves, make a case, make a little defense attorney before God. Well, it wasn't really so bad. I mean, if your parents were like my parents, you probably would have done worse. And it's a free country. I mean, it's not against the law, after all. Free consenting adult. We'll make a case, okay. And then if we're not making a case for ourselves when we're in fear, we will go over to the other side and just have utter contempt for ourselves. Just say, you lowlife, you are just disgusting. I mean, not only are you immoral, you're immoral in bad taste. There's no hope for you. And you go into it self-disgusting. That attitude, all of that stuff is the way, is an attitude of fear. And when we take when we start doing our inventory and writing down resentments, when we write down a resentment, we're not writing down stuff we deserve blame for. There's no one around blaming us. We write down stuff that we need healing for, that we need liberation about. We write down stuff where it hurts, where we have hurt them and we have hurt ourselves by hurting, and where we need some healing. Nobody's after us. And we have a higher power who loves us and treasures us. And when we have contempt for ourselves, that interferes with our relationship with God because it's not in harmony with our higher power's attitude. Higher power has compassion and acceptance in the same way any decent member of the fellowship has when you're talking to him. If you're pouring out what's inside of you, you don't have to be the world champion Avalon or AA member. All they have to be is just a regular attending the meetings person, you know? And with full of their own fears and freak out feelings and so forth. And if you start telling them what's on your mind, they're vastly relieved you're not as good as they thought. Because now they're probably going to be able to be honest with you. They receive you with, there's no, you did what? You know, this, has anyone ever in a participation meeting, someone got up and talked about abandoning their family in the Midwest and fleeing out here? Say, well, you know, there's consequences of that. I'm afraid we'll have to whip you. Every member of the group gets 5 lashes to pay the price. You know, that's not our business. On the other hand, the group doesn't pat somebody on the head and say, "Aw, poor baby. They probably were too demanding on you anyway." There's a respect for a person. It looks like you got some amends to make and some healing to go through, and we're going to stand by you while you do what's got to be done for healing. And once, you see, at that attitude, there's no reason to be defensive and make excuses. And there's no reason to despise yourself. Either one. Fear is the whole foundation of excuses and self-contempt. And once we get into the spirit of the program, it's putting down what we have to say because we need healing there. And when we take responsibility, you know, when somebody hurt us, you know, the big book says we don't dwell on the other person's inventory, what they've done wrong, If people have done wrong to you, there's never any reason to pretend they didn't.